Come on and get it, honey, while the getting's good, good, good.
Hello and welcome to Unapologetically Judith Owen. This is the podcast from Judith Owen. Hi, Judith Owen.
Hello, BB.
And me, BB Lynch. Now, Judith, I'm not suggesting I'm obsessed with you or even a little in love. I mean, let's let the lawyers decide. But I have been watching, reading, listening to all your interviews about your latest incredible album, Come On and Get It. And what comes across loud and clear is the album is, yes, of course, a beautiful homage to and a celebration of the unsung, brilliantly talented women of 40s and 50s jazz and blues. But it's also a celebration of how badass they were, their attitude, how unapologetic they were, and how powerful being unapologetic is. And that's what this series is talking about. Hi, Judith.
Hi, BB. You know, I didn't think you'd ever actually stop talking. No, if ever there was somebody to stalk me and that I would not be scared of, it would be.
I am short and I'm quite slight, but as a very buff friend of mine once said, and I said to him, who'd win in a fight, me or you? And he went to me, you, I'm bigger than you. He said, but you're angrier.
I should be very, very worried.
We've been talking in this series thus far about these incredible women and how unapologetic they were in various aspects.
Yeah.
And we've touched on this slightly, but I really want to go into this today because I really love this. They were unapologetically kind of pleasing themselves.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? They were doing it for themselves. And when does that ever happen?
My upbringing? Never. I mean, I was, you know, like I think so many children, and particularly girls, feel that they are put on earth to please, to be pleasers and to be diplomats and to make everybody happy and to keep calm. And I think that's probably, in fact, I know that's what, when I heard this music, when I heard Nelly Lutcher, when I heard these women singing for the first time, I was listening as a pleaser to women, as you said, who absolutely did nothing but please themselves. And when I say please themselves, I mean, they embraced being nonconformist, unpigeonholable, one of a kind, rule-breaking individuals who absolutely relished being unique and living according to their own rules, their own codes. I mean, they loved sounding different, being different. And at that time, of course, you know, musically, women were decoration. Yes, I mean, it's changed, but it hasn't changed that much, as we know. So it was always these beautiful, you had to be a good-looking woman at the front, an ornamental thing, a decorative thing on stage. Well, these women were just mostly at the piano or whether on stage, they were owning it. They were in control, but they were unlike anyone else. And they certainly didn't play, as I said, by the rules. They weren't delivering, you know, the romantic stereotype of music that nice girls were singing at that point. And even in their style, even in their musicality, in their piano style, in their singing style, they were unlike anybody else. I mean, you hear their voices and you know, within a second who they are. Like in any business, it's not called, you know, the music family. It's not called the music loving. It's called the music business for a reason, because it's about selling records. It's about selling product. I think that there's a couple of them that crossed those lines, you know, that managed to do something that was both incredibly commercial and they were doing stuff that was also unbelievably risque. And that was, I would say, Dinah Washington and Peggy Lee were the two that did that the most. In the most part, people, artists, and you, particularly women, who do not play by the rules, who cannot be put neatly into a mold or a category, are seen as being much more difficult to sell. Oh, they are much more difficult to, you know, everybody who's in this business has heard the line from some executive that said, you know, you're fantastic, but I don't know what to do with you. That is a given. That's pretty much what that means, is you're too original. You're too unique. I don't know. You know, it's like when somebody says to you, oh, what is that music like? Or what is that person like? You automatically will say, oh, it's like, and then you find an example. Well, what if then you know, imagine describing Billie Holiday when Billie Holiday first came out. Now, she's one of those great artists she was in a world where she was singing the Great American Songbook, but then she was also writing Strange Fruit. You know, that woman was able to do it all, but, and you could hear the pain just dripping from her. But we can say now, oh, she's like Billie Holiday. But imagine, Billie, you know, that's a one of a kind. If you heard Nellie Lutcher, if you heard Julia Lee for the first time, you couldn't compare these women.
They fronted male bands, and they didn't just front male bands. They really influenced great male artists.
Yes, they did. And I think garnered the highest respect from the greatest musicians. You know, Miles Davis, Bill Evans were looked at, Blossom Dearie, for example, as being the benchmark for greatness, for jazz greatness as a jazz pianist, as a jazz artist. I mean, Miles didn't think anybody took, you know, didn't, to be honest with you, he didn't see anybody white as being anything, you know, that was anything true to jazz. Blossom Dearie, he did. And thought she was the most extraordinary woman. She really was extraordinary. And Bill Evans saw her as just being a masterclass in piano playing. That's a big deal. Mary Lou Williams, she was a mentor as well as somebody that was writing songs for, you know, the Satchel Mouth, which I covered. She wrote that. That was a huge hit for Nat King Cole. I mean, she was an extraordinary powerhouse. She was a conductress. She was a band leader. She was an arranger, composer, pianist, singer. She was everything and mentored Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Miles. I mean, they all looked to her.
How did they have that? Because they were in a world where their race, most of the women that are on your album, and their gender were against them.
Well, let's just have a little trip down memory lane and just go through each of these women's lives.
Ooh,
just
what
to
should
give
I wear?
You an idea. How about a leopard top? There it is. I'll stay in yellow because that's how I'm feeling today. Like a giant buttercup
of
jazz.
No, you suit it.
Oh, thank you so much. So when you think about these, so many of these women as young girls, they were playing in church. That was it. That's what nice girls did. They played in church. They were playing, you know, religious music. They were there. They all turned secular. They all bust out. They bust out because they knew that they needed to be where the fun stuff was. They were adventuresses, you know, in that way. And I love that about them too. But it starts from that place and you can see it clearly where it comes from. So 11-year-old, you know, Nellie Lutcher, this gives you an idea of where does this come from? Okay. She's living in St. Charles, Louisiana. She's playing church music on the piano. Ma Rainey, bump and grind, gold-toothed Ma Rainey, blows into town and her piano player has gone absolutely on a bender, no doubt. And now they have no piano player. 11-year-old Nellie Lutcher is now playing piano for Ma Rainey. That's where it comes from. That's a badass. These women were, these were different times in the first place. 10 years old, 11 years old, 15 years old, they were already doing it. You know, this is what I mean. We think of childhood as a different thing. This was pre-teenagers having been, you know, invented the term teenager. People were doing this from like word one. So Nellie is sort of, she's somebody who already we know has got this backbone of iron, and you know she's got the balls. Thank you very much. And she then moves. She plays with various bands. She's continuing then, and when she's in her late teens, she moves to Hollywood, and she starts playing at a bar in a Hollywood hotel, in this jazz bar. And she'd only been playing piano. She'd never been singing. This is extraordinary. So she had a very, very own, you know, playing style. And the thing about her is that she would like, she'd sing along with her very punctuated piano playing. And she's got this giant glassed tip jar, as people did, and still do. Every time she would like burst into a riff of singing, just because she was having fun playing on her own, the glass jar would fill up. And people just start, this then started to just tip her to sing. That is not uncommon that many people, especially the people who will start out the piano and their whole thing is just playing background music or playing in bars, etc. And some at some point then start singing. So she started, she was the most, and Blossom Dearie was the same thing. She brings like 15 family members from Lake Charles. They come to Hollywood. She's supporting everyone. She always supported everybody.
And she's what, 13 when she's doing this?
No, she's now, well, no, that she's late teens now. So she then gets into, you know, then she starts to have hits. She starts to, she does, you know, Fine Brown Frame and Real Gone Guy. And she has a duet with Nat King Cole. And she has that incredible fame. But she, very, very tough life of touring and being on the road. From speaking to her granddaughter, Kira, who I'm so glad I met to ask all these incredible questions of, she told me a story that, and you're talking about the backbone that it takes to be that kind of, not only, you know, to be an African-American in pre-civil rights America, but to be a woman and to be an artist. And now they're touring around the South. I can't tell you what that must have been like, because honestly, it's not great even now. And there was this thing called the Green Book that told Black performers where they could go, where there were places to stay, where they let Black people stay, and where you could drive, and where you could stay overnight in the motels. And an extraordinary story about how they were stopped somewhere in the South by some KKK, some Ku Klux Klan people, and they stopped them, and they had like the big rifles out across the road, and they stopped the bus, and the piano's on top of the bus, and the band are in there, and they're all men, and they get out, and they get them out, and Nellie gets out, and the one guy says to her, "What do you do?" And she said, "We don't want any trouble. We're just going to our next gig. We're just musicians. And we, you know, that's it." And he said, "Get the piano down and sing. I'll decide whether you're going to the next gig." And they get the piano down. And basically, Nellie is playing for their lives. She's playing for their lives. And she plays. And the KKK guys love it. And they go, "Yeah." And off they go. And that is something that I'm not sure any of us could ever even wrap our tiny brains around.
There's something about, I think it enables you to be in the present, or maybe being in the present allows you to be unapologetic. If you've got all this stuff going on in your life, but at that time, you know your position, you know your place, you know your worth. None of these women have ever started an email with, "I hope this finds you well. Sorry to ask." Do you know what I mean?
You know what?
None of these women are
just... Yeah, you just said the word that none of them, I don't believe came into their lives, and that was the word sorry. Because
sorry.
I've said this to many Americans, you know, we joke about how much Brits apologize, you know. I make a joke during every show literally about, you know, "Oh sorry, sorry you ran over me. Whoops. Sorry I was in front underneath your front wheels. Sorry about that. Send me the bill please for the bumper." It's just like, what the fuck? It comes from that place of, I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to be an inconvenience. I don't want to be all, you know, confrontate. Oh, that is just a waste of life, of time, of energy. Every one of these women, like I said, it was a different time. I don't think any of them had the luxury. Let's be honest. They didn't have the luxury to go, they didn't, it was like, it's tough. Like Mary Lou Williams, she was, when she wasn't mentoring, when she wasn't being this extraordinary woman, she was also supporting like her, so many of her drug-addled jazz musician, you know, friends. That's something else that she, again, it's like, this is more than the musician. This is a person. This is the personality of these women. It's just so extraordinary. So here comes Pearl Bailey, singer and actress and a dancer, a comedian. She's like, if anybody, have you ever seen Carmen Jones? Have you ever seen the film, the jazz version of Carmen, the opera with Harry Belafonte? Yeah. And Dorothy Dandridge.
Oh,
there she is as Carmen's best friend. Literally, the woman is like a powerhouse. She's an 18-wheeler. That woman was something else. Being the second person that I heard in my dad's, you know, 45 collections, of, you know, as we've spoke about before, to hear her singing about a man and a best friend that's done her wrong, you know she's not really that bothered. You know what I mean? It's just like there's not an ounce of victim in her. There's not a second of sorry. She is a powerhouse.
What I loved about Pearl Bailey as well, they've got to this kind of wisdom about the power of being unapologetic young.
Yeah.
A lot of us, and kind of that's afforded to us when we're older, and it's like time's running out, we can't waste any more, so we kind of got to get what we want to get now. They seem to have that, and it could be circumstances afford that in them, but they have that, and that's what's so brilliant about them. But it isn't just musically, it's like you say, like across the board their whole attitudes. Didn't she kind of go, you know what, I want to marry someone?
Oh, yeah. She had this incredible line, because people were asking, you know, about during the civil rights time, et cetera. It's like, you know, what are your thoughts? What are you going to do? Are you marching? And she was sort of like, I live every day by the code that I believe in. I live the civil rights every day. And she really did. She was a rule breaker. Nothing that was set out seemingly by society, she would adhere to. She lived the way she wanted. And that included when she fell in love with the white drummer Louis Belson. And they weren't allowed to marry in America because you couldn't have mixed marriages. Can you believe this? This is just shocking, isn't it? Everybody think about it today. They went to London and got married because she wasn't having any of that. No, no way. And so that's what I mean. It's like living on her terms, the way she believed in it. She ended up being a peace envoy during the Gerald Ford. Yes, Gerald Ford sent her out to be a peace envoy. I think it was in Egypt with Anwar Sadat's side that I think when you say very, very correctly that most of us spend most of our lives, women, trying to get to a point, usually it comes after your 40s for sure, where you start to think, I don't give a shit what you think about me. This is who I am. I don't, you know, I don't care if I upset you. This is what I think. And I believe that, yes, they had this coming in because of their lives, because of how tough life was, because they had to start really early, because they were not going to be treated like they were poor cousins, you know, because they were women.
Dinah Washington, how was she uniquely her?
Oh my God. Again, they came in. These women, I believe, came in because they were still carrying all these people, like Nettie Lutcher was, like, you know, supporting her entire family. All these women were supporting tons of other people all the time. So quixotic. I mean, she's like something else. Between 7 and 9 husbands, no one quite knows. Thank you.
So let's go with 8.
Shall we just round it up nicely? Because that that appeals 8. To my OCD better. I can't cope with the odd numbers. Let's say 8.
Just say eight.
She was like this fire that was like this phenomenal, moody, exquisite. She had a voice that was mid-century, clear and brilliant and amazing. And I'm sure she was a complete pant load too, but don't we just love the fact that, you know, when she was signed to Mercury Records and Quincy Jones was the arranger and producer on Mercury, so he did a lot of recording with her. They would bring, I think the head of the label would bring in like song upon song upon song upon song, so she could have ones to choose from, because you just didn't know what mood she was in and what she was going to do and where it would land.
But she didn't care about being that woman.
That's
she was
the
happy
point.
To be that.
She was happy to go, no, hate it. She was the self-anointed queen of jazz and blues. And she was doing, and this
self-anointed.
Is for the
anointed.
Well, self, and it was self-anointed. She's like, I am. And she was a self-anointed. But what's great about her is that she was doing one of those raw variety performances. And Liz and Phil were, I you know, we were close. They were in the box. They were in the box and the royal box, and Queen Elizabeth is sitting up there. Phil's next to her having a good time. On comes Dinah Washington, and she looks to the audience and says, I want to tell you something. There is only one heaven. There is only one God, and there is only one queen. And your Elizabeth is an imposter. You can imagine you can imagine the crickets that went through the... No, supposedly there was like...
What's happening, yeah.
So, yes, lovely. Isn't she lovely? What is happening? Take her away. This, to me, it just screams of who she was.
They were these powerhouses, right? They wouldn't be hemmed in any way. And that's so incredible. And that's so empowering and so brilliant and strong and inspirational, etc. A, were they happy? And B, how has that inspired you? What have you taken from all of that?
Were they happy? I'm going to take a big, big guess at this one. On stage, musically, absolutely. Frustrated, probably by the business and by the hurdles that they were constantly forced to jump. For most of them, you know, I was thinking about Julie London. You know, there's a talk about the irony of ironies. She was so good looking. She looked like a pinup, and that went against her. You see?
Oh, listen, tell me.
I know. I'm looking at it, darling.
Yeah. Thank you.
And I think that the joy probably, if I can speak with my own experiences in hand, I would think for sure of having seen two of these women and reading so much about all of them, that they were absolutely happy in their art, in that place where they were their best, most authentic selves, and where they were seen as being, like I said, just these musical powerhouses, and as being the best at what they did. I mean, I can't imagine that wasn't an incredible feeling for all of them. That's what they wanted. That's what they did, to be recognized, to be seen, to be appreciated and understood. Here's the big one for all of us: to be accepted, be loved for being your authentic, unique self is the most important thing. But they still had lives and careers that are extraordinary. It's amazing what they achieved. And you look at them, every one of their lives reads like a movie. I know there's a movie being made of Peggy Lee right now. I hope it includes the other astonishing information which I found out, but just shows you the nature of this country and what it was like, and kind of still is in many ways, pre-civil rights. But she was seen as being so sexy and sultry and bluesy that a lot of the southern states banned her music, because they thought that on white radio, because they figured she absolutely must be black somewhere.
Are you trying to depress me?
I'm doing my best, darling, and I'm succeeding. But the thing is, all of this, to me, it makes it even richer.
A great friend of mine, Anna, describes these women, not specifically, but women like this, people like this, as real deal.
Yeah.
And what's brilliant about real deal is that's when stuff resonates. When you are true to you, that's when it resonates, and that's when it touches other people to the extent that it's moved you to make an album about them.
Yeah, I mean,
do you know what I mean? To make us do a pod about them.
I made this record because it was truly the antidote to COVID, and because I needed to turn towards my role models and these incredible women again to get that fabulous joy and the beauty that they bring.
You call them bottle joy. They are bottles of joy. I love that.
They are bottles of uninhibited, unapologetic joy. And every one of them twinkles like stars. And I didn't realize that by the very nature of doing it myself, you know, make the badass that has been gestating in me, the badass that's been gestating in me for since I was a child. I mean, seriously, that I've been kept, I've kept under wraps. I've kept her quiet inside, but she's always in, you know, she's there when I'm performing. She is there, and she's there in private when I'm just do what I, when I have this habit of always dancing. I dance a lot. I dance in private. I'm a private dancer. And I think Tina sang about me.
A dancer, oh, yes, for money.
Only my own. That's the sad truth. I tip myself. It's terrible. So I have always loved to put the headphones on and just dance myself into delirious joy, because that's what I do. I didn't expect to actually pull all the elements that I've learned in my life, that I had as a kid, that I had coming in, that I wasn't able to just be the I please myself. I couldn't be that person. I had too many things up against me that I had to be putting other people first. And, you know, I was raised to be very aware of what everybody else was doing and to take care of them first. And there was a lot of that going on. But I found myself making this record sort of knowing these women like they're my best friends or something at this point. I know them so well. I know their stories so well. Inhabiting this music, in loving it for my whole life, in hearing their voices, in enjoying them so much, it actually changed me. And everything I'd been keeping on the down low, everything that I'd been keeping quiet, the dancing, the dressing, the theatricality, the standing up, being present and accounted, but mostly the not caring if you liked this or not, if you liked me being this or not. If this was, you know, because people are used to me being a singer-songwriter. That's what I do. I'm very jazz influenced. You can hear that. I'm very blues influenced, but also classically. So this is a big change. And I didn't know, Bibi, whether people would kind of go, oh dear, something's happened. So
but it doesn't matter.
And that's the point. That is the point. It's like holding your nose and jumping in because you just, you know, is the water cold? I don't know. Will I drown? Maybe. But life is like that. If you don't hold your nose and jump in, you're not going to have ever known whether it was going to be great or not, whether it would work or not, if it would hit or not. You can only try. That's why we love over and over again the wrong people, because you know, it's the adventure of life. It's the thing of life that you can't afford to miss. If you live in safety, in fear, I'm going to say it because that's how I lived for a long time. And I'm a pretty fearless woman, as you know, but there's always been a part of me that has that, you know, that fearfulness and that darkness that I inherited, that I was taught to be a little bit fearful of life. No, what this gave me was the ability to just be braver, to be fearless, and to not care if you like what I'm doing, who I am, and how I'm doing it.
You can't give that gift back. I don't care if you've got the receipt, because you can't change once you've changed that way.
Oh, I love
that. Once you've changed that way, you can't change
back.
I
can't. And now I find myself, and I'm kind of liking it, unable to shut the box now. I can't close the box. So because she's out. Because now if somebody, she's out. So now if somebody asks me something, I'm like, I am answering honestly. Because it, you know, and sometimes I hear myself saying things and I'm like, oh God, I'm a bit of a moody bitch. And it's like, well, I am. I'm a moody bitch today. And I'll be happy. I can hear myself. And so I will say at the same time, I'm being a bit of a moody bitch because, you know, because I care so much or because I'm worried about this. I'm now, I think the worst thing in life, as we all know, is the secrets we keep. The less that, or rather, shall I put it, turn it the other way around? The more you store inside and push down and do not reveal and do not voice, the more choked up you get. Bigger the blockage in your chest, that feeling of weight on your chest. I mean, I was feeling really bad the other day. Things were getting me down. Things were worrying me. I felt stressed. I felt that block in my chest. You know that feeling before you cry, where you feel that tightness in your chest? And I did have a good cry. I mean, you know, I don't want to get deep and meaningful with you here because you weren't around. I tried you. You were off with some other loser. So
Judith, I was busy. I was watching Enders. I was catching up on Ian Beale, who, by the way, is a piece of shit.
Oh, don't.
But carry on.
Yes. I had a good old sob. And of course, guess what? I felt better because, and I use that as a very strong analogy, but you know what I mean? It's like the more you do the Brit thing and push it down, the more you do the, I will not let anybody see this. It's sort of like people actually like, unless you're offensive about it and like, you know, really aggressive with it. But people, I believe, relate across the board to people being more authentic and actually being honest rather than stifling.
Real deal.
Real deal.
You know, I've only got a few more minutes left with you because, you know, the ankle tag situation.
Yeah, is it beeping?
You understand, yeah. Right? We don't need to go into details. What were you going to tell me about Julia Lee?
You know, we've spoken about confidence and coming in complete and being the real deal. Here's something that I think is really interesting with all of these women. They were funny. Funny. They weren't take me seriously. They were so authentically funny. And, you know, funny woman is another thing that's not been accepted. We could do a whole thing on that. That hasn't always been easy for people to accept until recent times. But again, when you're decoration, it's a lot harder to be funny decoration. Mm-hmm. And that's another part that made these women standouts. And I'm going to leave you with one of what I think is the funniest anecdotes of all of these. I've given you some funny ones now. Julia Lee was asked to sing for President Truman, who was a bit of a stick up the ass. But, you know, presidents were actually presidents then. You know what I'm saying? And she went to the White House and sang King Size Papa. Which to me, I don't even know. I mean, I think Dinah Washington saying that to the Queen is one thing, but I think Julia Lee singing, I got a man who's almost over 8 foot tall. They take the door, and you know my favorite line, they take the door off the hinges when my baby comes to call. I think singing that to an uptight white president in front of all the, you know what I mean, all the lackeys in the White House, I think that's one of my favorite images as I imagine it in my mind's eye. I think that's just a keeper.
I love it. And I love that thing of them kind of using their onstage power to get away and do something they wouldn't be able to off, to actually kind of go, okay, right, I'm in charge here. Let's push
this.
They're doing it. I love it.
Right.
Chatting to you about all these women and then going back and listening to the tracks again, listening to the album again, and you're like, okay, and then there's this, the layers.
The utter layers. And I hope that the people, I really do want people to listen to the originals. Of course, I want them to hear this record, but I want them to know, having heard the stories of these women, then to listen to the originals and get that picture, to get that sense of what was going on, how extraordinary they all were. And yes, you've nailed it. That's a big part of this is on stage, they could do whatever they wanted. And you know what? And that's something they've taught me.
That is it for another episode. We're going to be back next week. I cannot wait. Huge thanks to you for listening, to you, lovely Judith,
thank
to these
you, darling,
women for making us do this podcast, because we just love it.
We love it.
For making all of you, for making this oral joy possible. Don't forget to come on and get us next week and to follow and give the series a review unapologetically. Judith Owen is produced by Pineapple Audio Production, and we will see you next time.
Come on and get